calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour, broadcasting live all across the United States of America. Amazing happenings today. First of all, Lawrence Wilkerson, the number two guy to Colin Powell. 16 years they worked together. This guy has been at Colin Powell's side for 16 years. And he left in January when Powell left. And now he comes out, and in a fascinating interview, the Associated Press interview, he says he basically blames the disaster that is Iraq right now on George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And on the one hand, he says Vice President Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and others, he says, but speaking specifically of Cheney, he said, this quoting from Ann Guerin's AP article, said, Cheney must have sincerely believed that Iraq could be a spawning ground for new terror assaults because otherwise, now I am quoting Lawrence Wilkerson, the chief aide to Colin Powell, the number two guy to Colin Powell. He says, because otherwise I have to declare him being Dick Cheney, a moron, an idiot, or a nefarious bastard. End of quote. I mean, this is the kind of language that people who have spent, you know, 16 years, who have spent their lives in government service, particularly at the highest levels of diplomacy in the world. I mean, being the number two guy to the Secretary of State of the United States, you learn how to use diplomatic language. You learn how to use, you know, very subtle words to just rip people apart. And yet here is, I mean, there's nothing subtle about this at all. Now, so on the one hand, he says, Cheney must have sincerely believed that Iraq could be a spawning ground for new terrorists. Otherwise, he would have to declare him a moron, an idiot, or a nefarious bastard. On the other hand, later on in the interview, he says, he has almost, but not quite, concluded that Cheney's and others in the administration deliberately ignored evidence of bad intelligence and looked only at what supported their case for war. So let's get this straight. On the one hand, Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's number two guy, Colin Powell's assistant for 16 years, including the time he was Secretary of State of the United States of America. Lawrence Wilkerson comes out and says, if Dick Cheney did not actually believe that Iraq represented a threat to the United States, he must be a moron, an idiot, and a nefarious bastard. And on the other hand, in the same interview, he says, and by the way, I'm almost convinced that he didn't believe it. In other words, he is essentially calling Cheney these names. He goes on to talk about how Colin Powell, raised loud and frequent objections to the Bush administration war policy, once yelling into a telephone at Rumsfeld, again, quoting Lawrence Wilkerson here, Donald, don't you understand what you're doing to our image? And, you know, clearly, apparently, he didn't. Because our image is in tatters. I mean, all around the world, people are looking at the United States going, you know, we always idealized the United States. We thought that America was the kind of country we wanted to become. We wanted to be more like America. Now we don't. We want to be like Sweden. We want to be like Germany. We want to be like France. This is remarkable. Now, here's another kind of, you know, left-hand, right-hand thing in this interview with Wilkerson. On the one hand, Wilkerson says that Powell is not asking him to make these comments. That, in other words, he's not speaking for Colin Powell. He's speaking for himself. On the one hand, when he calls Dick Cheney, when he suggests that if Dick Cheney didn't actually believe that Iraq was a threat, then he would have to be a moron, an idiot, and a nefarious bastard. On the one hand, he says he worked for Colin Powell for 16 years, and Powell didn't put him up to saying these things. At the same time, they asked him, you know, and he says he's somewhat estranged from Paul. Their relationship is strange, shall we say. On the other hand, he says, and again, I'm quoting Wilkerson here, what he, this is Powell, seems to be saying to me now, which kind of, now, this is Wilkerson saying that Colin Powell's still talking to him, so apparently they're not all that estranged. What he seems to be saying to me now is that the president failed to discipline the process the way he should have, and that the president is ultimately responsible for this whole mess. It's amazing. The Bush administration imploding. Just the great unraveling, to quote or paraphrase Paul Krugman, is well underway. Now, at the same time, a question comes to mind. You know, what do we do about this? And I think this is just great. I have, you know, many times in this program, people call and they say, you know, well, you know, who should be running for president of the United States? And I've always said that there are three national politicians, four Democratic national politicians that I think would have a good shot at becoming president of the United States, or should have a good shot at becoming president of the United States. Barbara Boxer, John Edwards, Howard Dean, and Al Gore. Al Gore, the only president of the United States who was never president of the United States. And over in the BlueOregon.com blog, Steve Novick is blogging. He says, let's bring Al Gore out. And I say, why not? I think, let's start a draft Al Gore. I mean, people say, well, Gore, he didn't win the election. Well, in fact, he did win the election, and we know that now, number one, number of 2000. Number two, this has happened before. There's precedent for this. Richard Nixon was vice president of the United States in 1960. Ran against John Kennedy. He had been vice president under Eisenhower, just like Gore was vice president under Clinton, for 8 years. Ran against Jack Kennedy and lost. For the first 4 years, he kind of stayed low, licked his wounds, got his act together, went out and campaigned for other Republicans as the former vice president. And 8 years after he lost that campaign of 1960, which, by the way, Republicans to this day believe was stolen, although that's a whole other argument. But the parallels here are spooky. In 1968, Richard Nixon came back and ran for president 8 years after he had lost and won. Why can't Al Gore do the same? People say, well, he's not the world's most inspiring speaker. Let me just share with you a very short clip of a speech by Al Gore. This is, Al Gore just, coming out and speaking out and just, saying what's on his mind here.
Because I think there were millions just like me who genuinely, in spite of whatever partisanship they may have felt prior to that time, genuinely felt like they wanted George W. Bush to lead all of us in America wisely and well. And the reason I'm recalling those feelings now is because those are the feelings that were betrayed by this president.
This guy's a barn burner. Now, you tell me that this isn't somebody who can give a political speech. I mean, Al Gore is brilliant.
He took America. He took America on an ill-conceived foreign adventure, dangerous to our troops, an adventure that was preordained and planned before 9/11 ever took place.
And here's another point. Al Gore gets it. I mean, he's right up there. He right up front. He gets it that Bush drove us in. In fact, he was one of the first Democratic politicians to come out against the war. One of the very first. I mean, he's got the credentials to run for president right now.
So whether it's the economy, where he said he'd be a moderate, or social policy, where he said he'd be middle of the road, compassionate, or foreign policy and military policy, I will say to the president that it is not a minor matter to take the loyalty and deep patriotic feelings of the American people and trifle with them for purposes that are not in the best tradition of America. And so I say to you in closing, my friends, in the year 2004, the truth shall rise again.
There you go. Well, and perhaps it did. You know, I still am of the opinion that Al Gore won 2000 and John Kerry won 2004, and nobody's going to convince me otherwise. Well, maybe somebody could. So far, nobody has. Let's see. So, Al Gore, draft Al Gore. Should we bring Al Gore out of the whatever you want to call it, wherever he is, and say, Al, come on, run? I think so. 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Are you losing your hair? Fight back with Avacor, now with Boost, which gives you visibly thicker hair with the first application.
I'm 20 years old and I've been losing my hair for 3 years. I started using Avacor and my hair stopped falling out. It's working.
Well, I'm 72 years old and I can tell you honestly, I have a fuller, healthier head of hair now than I did when I was 18 years old. Avacor really worked.
Whether you're 20, 72, or any age in between, Avacor works. An Avacor Boost will improve your hair's appearance the same day you receive your order. Call now and find out how you can get 3 months of Avacor free with your order. Call 1-800-884-6270. That's 1-800-884-6270. This is a limited time offer, so call right now. 1-800-884-6270. That's 1-800-884-6270.
While liberal and conservative groups alike are poring over the record of Judge Sam Alito to decipher where he stands on Roe versus Wade, who are those guys over in the shadows grinning from ear to ear? Those are the executives and lobbyists of corporate America, and they don't care whether Bush's new Supreme Court nominee even has a position on abortion. They're all grins because they know that whatever other ideological bent Alito might bring to the bench, he's a dyed-in-the-wool, tried-and-true, hardcore corporatist who can be counted on to favor big business over workers, consumers, environmentalists, shareholders, small competitors, and anyone else entangled in a court case against corporate power. After 15 years as a federal appeals judge, Alito's extensive paper trail shows that he's been a reliable and ardent champion of the corporate side in practically every case that comes before him. "We're always happy to see Judge Alito on the panel," says a Philadelphia lawyer whose firm represents some of America's largest corporations. Indeed, in several big cases, Bush's nominee has tried to prevent employees from suing corporations for sexual and racial discrimination, tried to protect monopolists from facing antitrust judgments, tried to stop environmental groups from suing polluters, and tried to reduce fines that corporate wrongdoers have to pay. As a beaming spokesman for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce put it, he has come down on a host of issues in a way that the business community would prefer. Adding that this is not a guy who's going to go off the reservation. This is Jim Hightower saying, and that's the real problem with Alito's nomination. We already have a court full of judges who side with the corporate powers. It would be good for our country and for the workaday majority of Americans if we had at least one Supreme Court justice with the independence and integrity to go off the corporate reservation, despite what the Chamber of Commerce big shots prefer.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Young man sitting on the witness stand, the man with the book says, raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear. The man looked down at his long hair. And although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. And it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
Yes, what is truth? Johnny Cash. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. There's a new movie out about Johnny Cash. I got to get out to see that thing. I've heard fine things about it, but Who knows? Anyhow, as we're seeing, as we're watching the Republican Party implode, we're watching Duke Cunningham walking off with millions. And by the way, I have to say, in Duke Cunningham's defense, I have to say that, you know, what he did was just the stupid version of what Tom DeLay does. Tom DeLay sits in his office. Somebody comes in and says, you know, we'd like to talk to you about thus and so. And he says, you know, show me who works for you to these lobbying firms. If you have any Democrats working for you, I won't talk to you. Show me how much money you've given to Republican causes, and then I'll be willing to talk to you. I mean, how is that different? How is that different? I don't see. Well, the difference, obviously, is that what Cunningham did was he just put the money in his own personal pocket, and Tom DeLay is putting it in political pockets, although Tom DeLay is flying around on corporate jets and staying in five-star hotels. It's just paid for by, you know, corporate contributors. The difference is that DeLay is enjoying this lifestyle based on, based on arm's length, as it were. The money all comes into his campaign, and the campaign puts him up in a five-star hotel. Cunningham says, give the money to me, and I'll buy a mansion. But in my opinion, the tragedy of it is that prostitution is rampant in Washington, D.C., and it has nothing to do with sex. And Tom DeLay is the classic example of it. Cunningham is, you know, the kind of idiot son here sort of thing. It is the tragic part of it. You know, he's the one that couldn't keep it together and got caught. But it's, you know, what he has done, what Randy Cunningham did is, in my opinion, not... Well, I'm not going to say it's not all that different from what the others are doing. Clearly, there are obvious differences. It was illegal. But the fact of the matter is that we have a political system. I mean, I was just looking this morning. Senator Gordon Smith, the Republican here from Oregon, where I live, $400,000 in campaign contributions that he's received that he's not disclosed the source of. I mean, you know, it's like you look at these kind of things and you go, what's going on? We have a system of essentially legalized bribery. And, you know, then somebody comes along with an illegal form of it, they get nailed, but the guys practicing the legal form of it, they get elected. And we really need electoral reform in this country. As Bernie Sanders talks about so frequently on this program, it is time for it. Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, and Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida on the line. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning, or whatever it is, wherever you are.
Yeah, there you go. All over the world.
I live in Tampa, but I lived 27 years in California, and I lived in that area. That area that Cunningham covered was Oceanside, where a lot of ex-Marines live, as well as Camp Pendleton. It's the very far north end of San Diego County.
Right, and in fact, his claim to fame was that he was a decorated Vietnam veteran.
Right, and yet he didn't live in the district. He lived in a place called Rancho Santa Fe, which is exclusively for the wealthy. That if you build a home, it has to be on at least one half of an acre. I think homes start there at probably $1.5 million. So he lived with the elite. But here's the real kicker on this guy. I won't use the language, but I hate him. Now let me tell you why. This guy was a big right winger, you know, law and order, law and order. Well, I want to tell you something. In the late 90s, his son was also a pilot. His son got busted flying in a cargo plane with, are you sitting for this?
I am.
2 tons of marijuana.
Hmm.
Into a small airport in the Boston area.
And so I'm assuming that since Randy Cunningham was a good Republican, that he figured out a way to keep his son from going to jail.
Okay, well, okay, now,
I mean,
normally,
gotta,
I think,
you know,
if you get...
His son was not African-American, right? His son was not poor.
Right.
His son was not, a hippie. His son was the son of a powerful Republican. So,
yeah.
Of course, he didn't go to jail, right? Or
so,
did he?
No, he did go. He did. I think he got something like a year in prison.
Oh, well, I'm impressed.
He would have gotten 25, but his daddy got in front of a good conservative Republican judge.
Yeah, he would have gotten life for that.
And what's interesting is that the judge had a senior moment, and he forgot about mandatory minimums.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah, when it came to the Duke son.
Yeah.
And Duke, the little crying act in the courtroom with his son, too.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, so the son gets off with a very, very, you know, like, what, you know, one...
A slap on the wrist, essentially.
Essentially. And yet this guy in his public pronouncements wanted a law to give death to anybody who brought in drugs.
Amazing.
Okay.
Amazing.
But when it's his own kid, he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know the 2 tons of pot.
Well, this is the problem with the Republicans and the whole Republican flag. For example, right now before the Supreme Court is this parental notification thing for kids who want to have abortions.
Yeah.
And the Republicans are out there saying, hey, if your kid has to get permission from her parents before she can have an appendectomy, why not for an abortion? Well, in the Beaver Cleaver world, you know, where everything is fine and everybody has, you know, Ward and June for parents, the Republicans are right. But it's not the Beaver Cleaver world. And the hypocrisy that you're pointing out, Phil, and so eloquently, is that when it's not the Beaver Cleaver world for Republicans, they figure out a way around it. When it is for everybody else, we're toast. 27 minutes past.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, the time will come up when the winds will stop and the breeze will cease to be breathing, like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where you get your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, where reason is our lifestyle choice. Lawrence Wilkerson, he's doing the circuit, I'm telling you. The piece I was quoting you earlier was from the Associated Press, and he had done an interview with the AP. The guy's got no book to sell. He's got nothing to flog out there. He's not making a living doing this stuff. And then he's on the BBC. The Guardian has an interview with him. He's on BBC Radio 4 on their Today program. And he says, you begin to speculate. You begin to wonder, was this intelligence spun? Was it politicized? Was it cherry-picked? Did, in fact, the American people get fooled? I'm beginning to have my concerns. He says, I'm beginning to have my concerns. He said it was an interesting question whether the vice president was guilty of war crimes. War crimes. He's in England saying this. Mr. Wilkerson told the BBC he had believed the intelligence supported the claim Iraq had a WMD program and had then initially accepted the administration's argument that the major Western intelligence agencies had been fooled. He said he has recently been troubled by disclosures that one of the key informants was unreliable, while the evidence for claims that Saddam Hussein had contacts with al-Qaeda may have been obtained by torture and was the subject of internal dissent prior to the March 2003 U.S.-led invasion. This is where it gets really interesting. This piece from The Guardian. Mr. Wilkerson said a statement from an al-Qaeda detainee that allowed Mr. Powell to present some pretty substantive contacts between Iraq and al-Qaeda to the U.N. Security Council was, quoting Wilkerson, obtained through interrogation techniques other than those authorized by the Geneva Convention. More important than that, said Wilkerson, we know that there was a Defense Intelligence Agency dissent on that testimony. Even before Colin Powell made his presentation, we never heard about that. So Bush is running around saying, oh, the people in Congress, they saw the same intelligence we did. Well, apparently even Colin Powell didn't see the same intelligence that Bush and Cheney saw, which said that there were serious questions about this. So why did Bush go to war in the first place? Again, there's a lot of folks out there who are saying, well, you know, he went to war for oil. That's what it was all about. That you had Dick Cheney out there.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and then, of course, you had George W. Bush. Just as he was announcing that we were going into Iraq, he was making the announcement we're going to start bombing Iraq, and he says, and, you know, the speech he gave to the American people. And then he turns to the camera and he says, and now I'd like to speak to the people of Iraq. And I'm sitting there waiting for him to say, you know, our kids are just, you know, our soldiers are just kids just like yours. And we don't want our sons and daughters to die any more than you want yours to. So why don't you just surrender? Because we're the mightiest military machine on earth and we're going to win. We're going to beat your army. So just give up right now and let's minimize the deaths. That's what I expected him to say. Instead, George Bush turned to the camera and said to the Iraqi people,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And all around the world, people's jaws dropped. And they said, holy cow, that's what it's all about. But I think that that's, I think that that was actually the benefit. I think that that's why Cheney wanted it. But here, I think, is why Bush wanted it. Cindy Sheehan laying this out in testimony before John Conyers, before Congress.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. So I agree with Cindy Sheehan that the reason George did this, and there's a great piece today, Timing Entwined War, Vote, and Election in the Los Angeles Times by Robert Brownstein and Emma Vaughn, which we can get into a little later on in the program, that basically lays this out. And I was writing about it at the time, in 2002 and 2003, that this was all about winning the 2002 elections, about taking back the Senate for the Republicans. That's what it was all about at that point in time. By the way, in our next hour, Lois Marie Gibbs is going to be on, the executive director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. How do you plan to balance the power from corporations to people in the battle against polluters? And in our third hour today, Nancy Anton with NewsHounds, the group, their slogan, "We watch Fox, you don't have to," is going to give us an update on the Fox holiday spin. And Senator Barbara Boxer will be with us. As I mentioned earlier, one of four people that I think would actually make a great president of the United States and might even have a chance to win. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Sandra in Everett, Washington. Hey, Sandra, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, what's up, Sandra?
Well, I just had two comments. One, I love your idea about Al Gore running. I think that would be a wonderful choice for the Democratic Party. And I'm also reminded that he was trying to warn us all about global warming, and everybody was trying to shut him up about that and telling us it wasn't an issue.
Yeah, we need a draft Gore movement.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. I think it would be a very strong position.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing that I think is probably far out on my belief system for me, but I can't help but feel that it would be justifiable, is as these investigations go on and as more is revealed, I would like to see the American public, especially those families who have lost loved ones in Iraq or who, soldiers who have come back disabled because of their service in Iraq, sue the people responsible in a civil suit.
The problem with that, Sandra, is that you can't sue a government official for the performing their functions without the permission of the government. You can't sue the government without the permission of the government. And so at least as long as Bush is in office, that's not possible. At least that's my understanding. I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that I'm not. And that, in fact, is why it hasn't happened, because, you know, I mean, there's enough lawyers in this country. If it was possible to sue Bush, he'd be being sued right now, I think. So, but, I'll leave that out there. Thank you for the call and for sharing your thoughts and suggestions with us. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. And Eric in Huntington Beach, California, you're live and on the air. Hey, Eric.
How's it going, Tom?
It's great. What's up?
Everything going on right now is about war profiteering and privateering. I mean, those are the core issues at hand right now. People like Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist,
right.
His family was involved, Tommy Frist Sr. and his brother, that's his father, and Tommy Frist Jr. were involved in stealing billions of dollars from the U.S. Treasury from Medicaid and Medicare.
Oh, they paid an $800 million fine, the biggest fine in the history.
Yeah, $1.7 billion they had to pay back to the U.S. Treasury.
Yeah. Yeah, plus this mind-boggling fine. I mean, it was absolutely huge. Yeah, absolutely. We have some serious ethical problems on the Republican side. Well said, Eric. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Where East meets West, huh, if you
yeah.
will.
There you go.
I was glad to hear you talk about Al Gore again, and that did prompt my call. As you probably recall, a couple times that I've been lucky enough to get through, that I've wanted Al Gore to run, along with others,
mm-hmm.
way back when. You probably remember that.
Vaguely. I'm sorry, Gary. I get a lot of callers, but
okay,
I'll trust you that you said it.
I think, and you raise a very interesting parallel. not only does Al Gore have that experience necessary, he's on the Foreign Relations Committee, right, for so many years.
Oh, yeah, for years, yeah.
For years and years. I think he had 8 years' experience on that. And I think the American...
Well, and he was vice president. I mean,
yeah, and not only that, I still think, even though he didn't win Tennessee, he comes from the South. I think the strongest ticket, in my judgment, is Al Gore and Evan Bayh, because Bayh brings credentials, Bayh brings experience, Bayh's a senator, and Bayh...
I have a problem with Evan Bayh because he's essentially the head of the DLC. I'd like to see Al Gore and John Edwards, or Al Gore and Barbara Boxer, or Al Gore and Howard Dean, although Howard Dean has forsworn the opportunity by becoming head of the DNC.
The interesting parallel that you brought up, and I thought about this before, but I forgot all about it, and kudos to you for bringing it up. The parallel is this: when Richard Nixon was only, he was vice president, obviously, there's a parallel.
Right, for 8 years.
And in addition to that, he promised, which he couldn't fulfill, to bring the troops home.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's multiple Nixon parallels, some good, some bad, and it's fascinating. Gary, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing that. John in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hey, John, you're live and on the air.
Oh, it's an honor.
Thank you.
In fact, I've just added Ultimate Sacrifice to my growing collection of Tom Hartman books.
Okay. my publisher thanks you.
What I called about was, I thought it was illegal to bribe a public official, which prompts me to ask why the Duke of San Diego, who has admitted to accepting bribes, is obviously in trouble. Why aren't the people who paid the bribes being prosecuted?
Well, I suspect they will be, but here's something even more interesting. The company that paid the bribes to Duke also has had a lot of business with the White House. This is, of particular interest. A lot of people are starting to look back at what has happened with this company and what they've been doing. And saying, hey, what's the deal here? MZM is the company, and they did some unusual business with the White House, notes the folks over at Think Progress. Over the past 3 years, MZM Inc. has been awarded several contracts worth more than $600,000 by the Executive Office of the President. They include a $140,000 deal for office furniture in 2002 and several deals for unspecified intelligence services. Now, why is the White House hiring this company to buy office furniture, this company that bribes Republican politicians? That should hopefully give some investigative reporters a little to chew on. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Why do the baby stars have enough food to feed the world? Why wouldn't there so many of us that there are people still alone?
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, why is the White House giving this same defense contractor money that Randy Cunningham was giving him? You know, this company. Who are they bribing in the White House? Could it be Jeff Gannon? Who knows? Anyhow, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. We're tuning in. This is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, Raymond in Cement City, Michigan. Hey, Raymond.
Well, how you doing today, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I have 2 points. One is, I know you talked about your front runners for the presidential campaign once we get there. I mean, we still have another election ahead of us. But I really think that the guy that we really should be putting out there is Wesley Clark. I think he's somebody who can organize. Things are such a mess. Organize and get the job done. And
which job?
He's got the real solid credentials.
Okay, which job do you think that Wesley Clark could get? You mean just all the stuff necessary to be president?
I think he should be president because what we need is somebody in that office who really knows the inside of the international situation, the military, the economy, and all these big issues coming up, and he is very, very well versed in those as well as a good troubleshooter and organization, and I think that's what we need. We need that solid leadership who can pull the rest of the team together.
Well, Raymond, with regard to the issues, I have to confess, I'm on Wesley Clark's mailing list, and I've been getting his stuff for a year and a half now, and or longer, and I still don't, and this may be my fault, not his, I still don't know exactly where he stands on progressive issues. You know, frankly, you know, what, for example, should we roll back Taft-Hartley? You know, what should be the position? What should be the relationship of labor to management in the United States? What kind of trade policies should we have? Should we do away with international, multinational trade policies and even the bilateral policies, so-called free trade, and go back to a tariff system? Something that I feel very strongly about. You know, what I think on the simple stuff, you know, environmental protection, you know, let's solve the problem of the Iraq war, things like that. You know, he's probably right there. You know, what's his position on campaign finance reform? Is he willing to take on big multinational corporations? I honestly don't know the answer to those questions. Do you?
Well, I think he's been very upfront in his previous campaign and on his where he is on and his issues on his website about creating jobs for you know, manufacturing jobs here in the United States.
But see, that's the point. What I've gotten from him have been that he's all in favor of that, but not the specifics about how to do that.
Uh-huh.
And again, maybe I'm missing something. You know, it's what, and actually, I don't want to turn this into a debate about Wesley Clark. But tell you what, Raymond, if you've got a good summary of Wesley Clark's positions on these, would you email it to me?
I'll make sure we get something along to you.
I'd love to see it, and for that matter, you know, David can poke around. Maybe we can get somebody on from Clark's campaign, or maybe even Wesley Clark himself to talk about these issues with us on the radio program. Thanks a lot, Raymond. It's a good one to raise. Janice in Pittsburgh. Hey, Janice, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. What's up?
Well, first of all, I think I love Howard Dean, but I realize he did say no since he's headed DNC, and that's great that he's there. So I am all for a Gore Boxer ticket all the way.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I wonder if you could comment on the involvement of the DLC in Dean's downfall in Iowa, because they were just as involved as the Republicans.
I don't disagree.
That's why I don't think Gore and Boxer could ever win.
Well, yeah, the DLC is making a bid to rise again. They're, you know, the Roll Call had a piece today about how, you know, the DLC is back. The new Democrats are back, you know, the Republican light, and they're going to be the new force in American politics, and not that they ever went away, really. And as I said earlier, Evan Bayh is one of the leaders of them, and he's portraying himself as a moderate, but in my opinion, these guys are just corporate shills. They're corporate shills who believe in a woman's right to choose on abortion. They're corporate shills who believe that the environment should be kept relatively clean as long as it doesn't hurt corporations too badly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're corporate shills who think that we should have clean elections, but they're corporate shills. And that's my problem with them. You know, we'll have to see how it plays out. In the third hour of the program, we get Barbara Boxer on. I'll see if I can raise some of these issues with her. Janice, thanks for the call. I got to move along. I appreciate it. Dan in Sicklerville, New Jersey. Hey, Dan.
How's it going, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I don't really have a question. I'll take your responses off air. I just wanted to get your feel on what you thought of a Gore Feingold ticket.
Feingold has disappointed me considerably recently in some of her positions. I'm just... You know, I think Barbara Boxer is a more progressive senator from California.
No, Feingold.
Oh, Russ Feingold. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Feinstein. Yeah, Russ Feingold. Yeah, I think Gore Feingold would be great too.
I was hoping he would take a stab at it in 04, but I kind of looked at it, but it didn't look like his seat was safe then. I think he ran for re-election.
Well, and not only that, I'm not sure. Although it's really difficult to judge the intentions of any senator, but I don't know to what extent Russ Feingold really wants to get into that battle. I think my sense of it is that he thinks he's doing a great job in the Senate, and he is by and large, and wants to stay there. But maybe, I mean, Russ Feingold would be another one who, you know, I would be very enthusiastic about.
Yeah, that's what I like to do too.
Yeah. So just you're welcome. Thanks for calling, Dan. I mean, you know, so just in a nutshell, we've got a lot of opportunities here. There's a lot of very good talent out there. A lot of people who would make great candidates for president of the United States. But I got to say, I still think, you know, Al Gore is the guy. Al Gore is the guy who really has the potential to pull America together. And just, you know, just he was just so good.
It's because those are the feelings that were betrayed by this president.
He
betrayed this country.
He betrayed this country. There you go. And I think, you know, we can't forget Al Gore. I mean, if the Republicans could, you know, bring Richard Nixon out, dust him off in 1968, prop him up and say, hey, right, you know, we should be able to do the same with Al Gore, right? Or maybe he should. Although he says, you know, he's having fun in the private sector and all that. Draft Gore. Somebody needs to create a draft Gore committee. I'd love to see it. I'd be the first to send my $5 towards it. Whatever. Anyhow, we'll see how that goes. And as mentioned, coming up, the executive director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, Barbara Boxer, Nancy Anton, much more. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, CRN Digital. Of course, on radio stations, as we mentioned, from California to Pennsylvania. Welcome back to our program. 1976, Lois Gibbs, resident of Niagara Falls, New York, read a cost-benefit analysis of Love Canal. When her son became ill with pneumonia, she learned that his school was built on a dump site of Hooker Chemical Company and began the crusade, began the campaign. Lois, just for the welcome to the program, first of all.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Lois is now the executive director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, www.chej.org. And Lois, could you give us just a, for our listeners who may not have been, you know, alive or conscious or paying attention to the news back in the 70s, and I guess it was 80, 81, really, that the Love Canal came to a head. What happened, what your role with that was, and how that led to what you're doing now?
Well, in a nutshell, I was your average mom, staying home, taking care of my children, living what I call the perfect American dream life as a stay-at-home mom. And after moving into Love Canal and setting up my house, 2 years later, Michael, my son, who was perfectly healthy before moving in, became very, very sick. And he developed epilepsy, he developed grand mal seizures, he had liver problem, urinary tract disorder, which required 2 operations to correct, and on and on and on. And I gave birth to a second child at Love Canal, Melissa, who developed a rare blood disease. And I kept on searching, like so many of us moms out there, saying, what is going on? I'm perfectly healthy, my husband's perfectly healthy. Why are my children so sick? And I just opened a newspaper one day, and I found that there were 20,000 tons of chemicals buried 3 blocks from my home and underneath the elementary school that my son was attending. And I was just stunned. How could anybody sell me a house 3 blocks from a dump and not tell me? It wasn't obvious. You know, everybody has these images of dump sites and contamination of barrels and chemicals coming out. Well, it just looked like an open field. And to build a school on the perimeter of the dump and the playground right over the top was just, it was just unbelievable to me. And so I started to talk to some of my other neighbors and say, well, gee, you know, are your kids sick? Is it the school? Is it the neighborhood? And we were shocked to find that the entire neighborhood, which consisted of 900 working-class families, were very, very sick. We had a birth defect rate that was about 56% in our children. We had a high rate of central nervous disease, just a whole host of things, miscarriages, stillborn babies. And that's when, as a community, we decided that somebody needs to do something about it. It's not our fault that we bought these homes because we didn't know about it, and somebody needs to fix this problem. And so we organized and began to fight the state and Occidental Petroleum, who bought Hooker Chemical Corporation, which is a huge multinational corporation, and the federal government to try and get some relief. And it took us 3 years, and we finally got the federal government under President Jimmy Carter to appropriate enough money to purchase the homes of all 900 families who wished to leave and to begin to do some cleanup of the 20,000 tons of chemicals that were in the center of the neighborhood.
Remarkable.
It was amazing because, you know, I hear people, you know, I started the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice afterwards, and I just had call after call after call from women and men, but primarily women, who were in exactly the same place saying, I didn't know. Nobody told me.
In communities outside of Love Canal, you mean?
In
other parts of the United States.
Yep, from Riverside, California, to Miami, Florida, to Nova Scotia, Canada. I mean, literally around the world, but primarily in the U.S. saying, oh, my goodness, you know, something's going on here. I remember in Brownsville, Texas, where a mom called me up, and she said they had 12 children who were born with their brains outside of their skull. And whether I thought that could be due to the river there, the Rio Grande, that was totally contaminated with pesticides and other chemicals that they were using for drinking and bathing. So, it wasn't an isolated incident. Love Canal actually sort of brought to the public attention that there's probably a lot of these out there and people should pay attention.
I should add, by the way, that Lois Gibb this is our Bioneers segment, founded in 1990. Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. And you have spoken at the Bioneers conference, bioneers.org.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and me too. And so here we are.
It was a fabulous conference with thousands of people coming to say, okay, we understand a lot of the problems. We need to learn more. But what do we do about them? And so a lot of people were there to figure out what do we do, which I thought was really very, you know, stimulating.
And speaking of the what do we do, you run the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. The website is chej.org. And on the front page of your website, a number of issues. At the very top, say no to testing pesticides on orphans and abused children. Now, this came up about a year ago, as I recall. The FDA floated this thing. It got shot down. It's back.
It is back, but it's even back. I mean, before they were going to test pregnant women and children with consent. Now they're talking about going ahead and testing orphans, state-awarded children. So those are children who are abused or neglected. They're looking at children from other countries. I mean, it's just unbelievable what this administration is trying to do. And the reason they're doing it is so that the pesticide industry can hold on to these, about a dozen chemicals that are going to go off the market in August of 06 if they don't prove that exposure to those chemicals by small children is somehow safe. And we all know pesticides is a neurotoxin, and we all know that children are the most vulnerable to neurotoxins or any kind of chemicals.
And I think common sense would indicate that just because exposure to a chemical, to a child in particular, this week doesn't cause a problem. I mean, this was the great lesson of radiation.
Yes.
That doesn't mean that 5 years or 10 years down the road, it won't cause a problem. I remember when I was a kid, 7, 8, 9 years old, walking home from elementary school, there was a shoe store on the way home. This would have been in the mid-1950s, late-1950s. And we used to walk in the store and stick our feet in a machine where we could wiggle our toes and watch the bones in our toes because it was a continuous stream of X-rays coming through the thing.
Yeah,
you know, they pulled those things off the market now, but it's like, you know, time passes and bad stuff can happen.
But this is even worse. I mean, we're taking children who are already abused, already neglected, children who are orphans, have no parents, and we're just going to take them and experiment on them. I mean, that is so un-American. That is so morally wrong. And, you remember that debate that was only last summer about Terry and her feeding tube, and what do we do with Terry, and do we keep it in and keep it out?
Terry Schiavo.
So on one hand, you had all of these sort of Republican, you know, folks and other folks, Democrats alike, saying, you know, how they feel about that. Well, on the other hand, you have this thing going through EPA, through the regulatory process that says, here are healthy children who have already been somehow harmed, or at least not, doesn't have a mama and a daddy, which means there is some harm as a result of that, and we're going to experiment on them. It's just, you know, I just stunned. I mean, there's not even words to explain how awful that is, morally, ethically, and scientifically.
Yeah, when I first got a hold of the proposed rules, I noticed also that they suggest that if these kind of tests are done outside the United States, the standards are even more lax.
Yeah, one of the things that we're guessing, and we don't really know this, is that the pesticide industry has a study that was done on orphans in some foreign country that they want to introduce as evidence that children will not be harmed by pesticides. And that's why they wrote this exception to the rule. And, you know, we just have to stop this madness. This is just, we don't use children to experiment on, and we don't use children who are the most vulnerable socially to experiment on. This is just unbelievably bad. I'm ashamed to be an American when these things happen, you know?
The flip side of it is we can be proud to be Americans when we can talk about this on the air, and we can hopefully do something about it. Because Lois Gibb, we have less than a half a minute or so to go. Who in the administration was responsible for putting this forward?
This was actually presented by Stephen Johnson, who is the EPA director now, administrator.
What did he do before that?
He worked in the pesticide section of EPA. He was a rank and file pesticide guy who thinks that no chemical can harm anybody at any level.
Yeah, and I'll bet there's a nice job waiting for him in the pesticide business when he's all done with his government service.
I'm sure there is, but we're hoping to get 100,000 signatures on a letter that we're going to submit to EPA and to the
great
legislature.
And if you'd like to take action on that, you can go to CHEJ, as in Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, CHEJ.org, and just click on the link. It's right there. Lois Marie Gibbs, thanks so much for being with us, Lois.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
Keep up the marvelous work you're doing. Honor to have you on the program. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
I heard the morning dream. I felt the wind change. Too many times I'm on my way. Come on, sunshine. What can you show me? Where can you take me to make me understand?
And welcome back, my friends.
The wind can shake me. Brothers forsake me. The rain can touch me. Again, I touch the rain.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Our telephone number 1-866-440-THOM. We'll be getting to your calls in just a moment. First, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News is with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C.
Good day. Well, I will tell you that Porter Goss, who's the CIA director, gave an interview to ABC television yesterday. I believe it was broadcast this morning. And in it, he said, he was asked about what his definition of torture was. And he said, well, I define torture probably the way most people would, in the eyes of the beholder. What we do does not come close because torture in terms of inflicting pain or something like that, physical pain, or causing a disability, those things that probably would be in common definition for Americans, sort of, you know, when you see it. We don't do it because it doesn't get what you want. We do debriefings because debriefings are the nature of our business, which is to get information.
Then why do we ship people to other countries to be tortured?
Well, that's a very good question. And the European Union, this was reported this morning by the Financial Times, but a senior diplomat who wanted not to be named said he couldn't have been clearer, they say. You don't talk about torture in the morning and then in the afternoon say democratize yourself.
Right. Now,
also, Frank Walter Steinmeier, who is the new, he's making his inaugural trip, he's the new Germany's new foreign minister, he is expected to speak to Condoleezza Rice about these prisons.
Good, good. Ellen Ratner, the Associated Press is reporting today, and the Independent in London as well, that Lawrence Wilkerson, for 16 years, Colin Powell's right-hand man, Lawrence Wilkerson, in an interview with the Associated Press yesterday, said that on the one hand, he would have to believe that Dick Cheney sincerely believed that Iraq was a threat. Quote, otherwise I would have to declare him a moron, an idiot, or a nefarious bastard, end quote. And then a little later on in the interview, he goes on to say that he's really not sure that he believes it yet. He said he's almost but not quite concluded that Cheney and others in the administration deliberately ignored evidence of bad intelligence and looked only at what supported their case for war. In other words, Cheney is a moron, an idiot, and a nefarious bastard.
Well, that may be, but I want to tell you, I have it from the most highest sources in Washington, Republican sources, that this
that he would not have talked Wilkerson, even though he is distancing himself from Colin Powell, unless he had Colin Powell's permission.
Well, and in fact, that's the other thing. On the one hand, he says that Powell didn't put him up to this, and in fact, he's estranged from Powell. And then he's quoted as saying, quote, "What Powell seems to be saying to me now is the president failed to discipline the process the way he should have, and the president is ultimately responsible for this whole mess." Now, he's quoting Powell now, in quotes, now. Yeah.
I know people who know this most internal situation.
So
he would not have done it without Powell giving him the wink and the nod and saying, go ahead.
So here we have then,
you know,
by proxy.
In the business, no fingerprints.
Yeah, here we have by proxy the Secretary of State of the United States for 4 years, Colin Powell, the, you know, a cabinet official in the Bush administration, calling the Vice President of the United States a moron, an idiot, and a nefarious bastard. I mean, talk about strong language for a diplomat. How is this, you know, how is this flying in Washington? What's the response? How is the administration going to react to this?
Well, the administration is, you know, they're not reacting. I mean, they're simply saying that's his viewpoint. You know, they give you all that same runaround, just like you just heard about when the, you know, when he was the CIA director was questioned. He just gives you a gobbledygook answer. That's what we get from the administration. Now, in all fairness, they have not been around to have questions for 5 days.
Yeah. Now I'm you know, just waiting for them to find the dead hooker in Wilkerson or Cheney's trunk. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, they outed Joe Wilson's wife. I mean, what are they going to do to these guys? It's just, I'm just amazed, frankly. It's that Colin Powell would feel so strongly that he would authorize Wilkerson to use that kind of language. I mean, I could see saying something like, you know, we have, you know, Colin Powell had strong disagreements, but to call the guy a bastard, it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. What else is going on in Washington, D.C., Ellen Renner?
Well, I think that, you know, we're really definitely seeing something, patterns. And, of course, we're seeing patterns of governments totally and completely not having to deal with anything and not wanting to deal with anything. And then Joseph Lieberman today is on CNN and saying that he's seen economic, political, and military progress in Iraq.
He's got an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that.
I mean,
Joe Lieberman is like, he's a poster child for the Republican Party.
He's definitely not a Democrat.
Yeah, he's certainly not my kind of Democrat. It's tragic to see, you know, and from the state of Connecticut, no less. I mean, do you know when Joe Lieberman is up for re-election next?
Right now.
Really?
Yes. Well, maybe it's 08, but I do know that there's rumors that the former guy who we lost against, the governor, why am I blocking on his name?
You mean the Republican?
He was Republican, became independent.
Uh-huh.
Lowell Weicker. Has been very upset. Some people say he may even run against him again.
Wow, Lowell Weicker was a decent Republican.
Yes,
I mean, he was an Eisenhower Republican.
That's right.
Amazing. Fascinating. Well, Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News, thanks so much for being with
you
us, Ellen.
It.
Thanks for the insight. Great talking to you. Amazing. Lowell Weicker may take on Joe Lieberman. You know, again, it's like I'd say the only Republican I've ever voted for in my life was the, well, we'll get into that after this. 27 minutes past the end.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some new up above us.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, coming up on 25 before the hour. Indeed, as I was saying before we went into the last break, the only Republican that I've voted for in my adult life, because I couldn't vote for Barry Goldwater at 64, I was only 13 years old, the only Republican I've ever voted for was Jim Jeffords, and he was my senator in Vermont, and, you know, I swallowed hard and said, okay, he's a Republican, but I'm going to vote for him anyway. And why? Well, because Jim Jeffords had some pretty good things to say. This is a speech from a couple of years ago, just a couple of clips from Jim Jeffords, and we'll get to your phone calls. But this is a guy who started being, he literally has been a Republican his entire life. Jim Jeffords is now in his 70s. He's retiring from the Senate. Bernie Sanders is running for his seat. And he has held that seat as a Republican for years in Vermont. He's been an active Republican politician since the 1950s, Jim Jeffords, and always a Republican. And finally, Bush got to him, and he said, "That's it, I'm leaving." But here's Jim Jeffords speaking about these issues.
Well, President Bush hasn't just overreached. He has set a new standard for extreme partisan politics that on many occasions has been supported by the Republican-controlled Congress. In place of thoughtful policy, we now have superficial and cynical sound bites. Instead of confronting pressing national problems, our president lands airplanes while Rome burns.
This is Senator Jim Jeffords, Republican his entire life.
I am pleased to see calls for congressional investigators to determine whether the president manipulated intelligence information to build support for the war. Why the hurry to invade the country and use military force in such an unprecedented manner? Where was the imminent threat to the United States? And where are the weapons of mass destruction?
I'm telling you, there's a lot of decent Republicans who are asking these questions that Jeffords says out loud.
His polls and famous advisors tell him to talk about compassion and job growth and how he is helping Main Street. But that is all it is. It's his talk. In reality, he adopts hard right proposals that favor those who need help least and neglect those who need help the most. In reality, we are now in the longest period of continued job loss since the Great Depression. Since the beginning of the Bush administration, 2.7 million private sector jobs have been lost, and the number of unemployed Americans has increased by over 45%.
Yeah, and then, even more telling, Jim Jeffords was asked on public radio in Vermont, just on a local station, on a local show, why he thought Bush went to war. Here's the question and then the answer, and then we'll get to the phones.
But does the situation now in Iraq essentially show that he made the right decision?
I don't believe so. I was against it at the beginning, and I'm still against invading Iraq. I think it's created huge problems. I feel that we should never have gone in there. I think it was all done to get oil. I think that that's the end result is going to be some oil agreement. And to the loss of life that we had and to the cost of it was to me just a re-election move, and they're going to try to live off it and probably start another war. Wouldn't be surprised next year, probably in Iran.
Do you think that's likely?
Well, I'm probably shouldn't even talk on it. I just feel so bitter about the thinking that's gone on behind them and the reasons they go to war and went to war. But I feel very strongly that they're looking ahead and that there'll be an opportunity to go into Iran and try to get their son elected president. I don't know, but they do it each time they when I have a new president. I'm very, very, yes. Oh, well, I better be quiet.
Yeah, and Jim Jeffords at that point began to censor himself. The Republican senator from Vermont, now an independent, but this is an interview from a couple of years ago, and you could see the transformation. You could see, you know, he's going, whoa, hey, wait a minute, and talking about, you know, yeah, next they'll have another war, and they'll try to get Jeb Bush in. 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Deanna in Sacramento, California. Hey, Deanna, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I so enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I heard yesterday you talking about some of the candidates for presidency, and I think you were right on when you were saying an independent often messes things up in regard to divvying up the vote, but I think we've come to a point with enough Republicans who've jumped ship and surely don't want to side with the Democrats, but they would be willing to go with independent. And that's why I think the Bernie Sanders and Barbara Boxer ticket would be outstanding, because that appeals to both sides of that. And
yeah,
Bernie,
I agree, but Bernie is not going to run for president. He's got his sights set on the Senate.
let's hope that if we need him bad enough, he might consider. Because I honestly think that enough people will be willing to come play in that sandbox. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If Sanders boxer,
I
tell you, that sandbox would be appealing to, I think, both sides.
There you go. Okay, good one, Diana or Deanna. I don't disagree. I know Bernie, and I know that he's not going to run for president. But you know, he would. I would vote for him in a minute. Maureen in Seattle. Hey, Maureen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. A pleasure to speak with you again.
Well, thank you for calling.
I wanted to address a couple things that has to do regarding our children in our country. And first of all, I was just appalled at what Lois Gibbs was saying about the children being experimented upon. It's just appalling. And something that I have been thinking and writing about has to do with what our children are watching and what they're seeing as role models in our country and by this administration and the cronies of the administration and the power plays that have happened. Can I address a few points that I've been thinking about?
Sure, if they're brief.
Okay. Well, one is that I think that we are failing our children when we don't realize that what they're watching is it was better when I was written but that we're failing them.
You mean by what they're watching? They're watching, for example, Tom DeLay say, and in the press, it makes
press,
no embarrassment
the lies,
about it.
The
you
cheating,
know. Yeah.
The debasing of our lands. And that this is, that it's so, in a way they're being told that this is okay. And I think that what's happening with our children when we see the violence happening so early on in elementary schools, when we see that there's drug and alcohol abuse in our kids starting in middle school, when we, and through high school, when we see on the college campuses, I have a son in college now, and the stories that are coming back of the kids that are ending up in the emergency room getting drunk.
Well, it's like they're becoming nihilists, you know. They're like, you know, life may end any minute, so eat, drink, and be merry. I mean, it's because and there were, you know, there were shades of that. I remember, you know, back in the 50s and 60s with the bomb hanging over us all, but still there was this belief that with the United Nations in particular and Dag Hammarskjöld really gave us a lot of hope in the 50s and early 60s.
And I'm from that era too, and I agree there was a different kind of hope. And even with the 60s generation with drugs and sexual freedom happening, there was still something that was driving us ahead.
Yeah.
And
it was more of an exploration,
yes.
I think, Maureen, than it was a let's give up and get drunk. And that's
it's a hopelessness that's permeating our kids and the things that are coming across on the television.
I don't disagree with you at all, and I think you raise a great point, and I thank you for calling and making it, because this, we really do need to be communicating that there is hope, and I really believe that there is. I mean, people say, oh, you know, America's going fascist. I say it. America, we're heading in the wrong direction, right? Yes. But, you know, and people hold up Germany as the example, you know, of what we've done. And yes, a lot of the playbook of the Bush administration is clearly coming out of Goebbels and coming out of the history of Germany or something very similar, at least a similar mindset. But the fact of the matter is that the German people had experimented with democracy for less than a generation when Hitler took over. They had had a king for 1,000 years. They'd had their Kaisers for a millennia, for probably more than 1,000 years. And they wanted another king back, and they got one in the form of Hitler. We have had, on the other hand, democracy in the United States. Yes, it hasn't been perfect. Yes, we've made a lot of mistakes. Yes, we had slavery. Women couldn't vote, blah, blah, blah. However, we have had the ideals of democracy held up as this is what we're all about. This is where we're going to go somehow, someday, step by step. We have had that held up for over 230 years in this country, and that gives me great hope that we're going to end up going in that direction. Jeff in Maricopa, Arizona. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I got to disagree with you about Barbara Boxer.
Okay, why?
Were you aware that she voted for CAFTA?
No, I was not.
Yes. Her, Dianne Feinstein, Patty Murray, and Maria Cantwell, all supported by Emily's List, which I used to be a sustaining member of Emily's List. I'm sorry, but one issue candidates just don't work for me anymore. There's
Hang on just a second. You know, one issue voters don't work for any of us.
Yeah.
You know, if that's the only bad vote that she cast, I'll let her slide. But if that's symptomatic of a larger belief in corporatism and some sort of an alliance with the DLC. Well, I don't know. You know, I'd have to learn more about it.
It just appears to me
that what she actually did was she sold out 100,000 workers who are going to lose their jobs.
Well, it's that's tragic, Jeff.
Some, in all likelihood, some political deal. She traded her vote for she traded her vote for something else.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to know what that is. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call and for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, our telephone number. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, The Democracy Zone. Talk radio for the rest of us, exposing the con and conservative 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
Indeed, what is truth?
A little boy of three, sitting on the floor, looks up and says, Daddy, what is war? Son, that's when people fight and die. A little boy of three says, Daddy, why? Young man of 17 in Sunday school, being taught the golden rule. And by the time another year's gone around, it may be his turn to lay his life down. Can you blame the voice of youth for asking, what is true?
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Let's see here. Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yeah, talking about presidential candidates, I think most of these Democrats being discussed are a complete joke. Other than Russell Feingold, I wouldn't vote for any of the other ones they're discussing. And, I'm starting to forget what I came to talk about. I would recommend my own congressman for president, Peter DeFazio.
Okay, I'll go with you on that. I interview Peter every week on my local program, and he's...
Oh, you
he's
do? Well, yeah. I wish I could hear it.
He's on the air every week here on KPOJ. Well, there's a web stream if you want to listen to it. But Joe, thanks a lot. I absolutely agree with you. Peter DeFazio is one of the most progressive members of the House of Representatives. He's a good guy, and I would vote for him for president in a heartbeat. But again, like Bernie Sanders, I know that he has no interest right now in running for president. And so he's not moving in that direction. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I called in regarding a Thomas Paine biography that you mentioned earlier today. I guess you talked about one of your favorite books, and you said you read a real brilliant biography on Tom Paine. I can't find any review you wrote about that or something.
I haven't written a review of it. It's called Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. It's by Harvey Kay.
Okay.
It's absolutely brilliant.
I thought your guest, the female guest on your morning show, said she read something.
She read a review that I did of Thomas Paine's own writing, The Rights of Man, yeah. And
okay.
I did that for BuzzFlash, and she thought that's what I was talking about. But no, what I was talking about, there's a new biography out by Harvey Kay called Thomas Paine.
K-A-Y-E.
Called Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And it is, in my opinion, probably the best political book of this year.
Great.
And
hey,
maybe the last 5 years.
Things you guys are talking about. I mean, you have callers talking about wouldn't vote for any of these disgusting Democrats. They have to remember a bad Democrat is still better than a so-called good Republican.
Yeah.
And you got to be practical. It's about winning. It's not about holding on to your idealistic, you know, views of the world.
Well, I think actually it's about both, Tom, because if we can get Democrats into power, then we can begin leaning on them really hard and moving them in an appropriate direction. This is exactly what the conservatives do, the Republican Party.
No, but I would say Clinton and Clark. Everybody says, oh, Clark's not progressive enough, but he gives you the military strength card, and
mm-hmm.
Clinton gives you the prosperous times.
Hillary Clinton.
Huh?
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, Clinton Clark. Yeah. That's the meme. Clinton Clark and the
Well,
meme.
It wouldn't surprise me if that's the ticket that we end up with. And if it is, you know, I would vote for Hillary Clinton.
Because that's a winner, even though they're not progressive enough for me.
Yeah.
They're not Nader-like enough, but, you know, it's a winner.
I'm right there with you, Tom. I agree that, a bad Democrat is better than a good Republican. On the other hand, you know, in some ways, Bill Clinton began the process of selling us down the tubes, particularly with his trade policies. And, it's just we just have to hold these guys accountable. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning. It's always a pleasure speaking with you. You know, I studied literature and writing in college, and as part of my degree, I also studied journalism. And since I was in college in the early 80s, Bob Woodward was one of my, well, one of my heroes. I looked up to him. He was the investigative journalist, and Tom, I fancied myself an investigative journalist. Not a great way to make friends in college, especially out of staff if you're writing things they don't like. And especially if your editor is a conservative man and doesn't really want to publish them either. And this is a college newspaper. But Bob Woodward really was, you know, one of my heroes. I looked up to him. He had found out.
You're speaking in the past tense, sir, Scott.
And now it seems that the biggest story in recent history happened, Tom, right underneath his nose.
Yeah, I just said you're speaking in the past tense. You said he was one of your greatest heroes. I assume he's not any longer.
Not anymore, not after what's happened with this whole leak affair. He was privy up front to this whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He
was
didn't write a word about it.
Well, not only that, I don't know if you've read his books about George Bush and war, you know, Bush at War and the other one, I'm forgetting the title. He tries to present them as like balanced looks at the administration, but they're basically suck-up jobs. They're, you know.
Yeah, I read the news of them, and that's why I won't read them. I have too much other good stuff to read, like, well, sorry, Tom, your books. And I don't have time to read that kind of stuff. I have read excerpts from it, and pretty much he makes these guys look good to be like ordinary people caught in bad circumstances.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I guess it's just a reflection of what he believes about himself. But, Tom, I got to admit, is he kind of an icon, an example of what's going on all over American journalism now? It just seems kind of strange.
Yes. The short answer is yes, and it's all about money ultimately is what it comes down to, is that, you know, the news divisions of the networks have been taken over by the entertainment divisions, which are run by as a business. It used to be that news wasn't run as a business. It wasn't run for profit. It was run in order to keep stations' licenses, because the law said that you had to perform community service to have a license to use the free airwaves.
And I remember those days when I was young, during Watergate.
I did radio news for 7 years back in the 70s, and you know, we had to do news. The networks had to feed news. They had to feed news to the TV stations in our neighborhood and it had in the United States, and it had to be real news because it had to qualify as community service.
And
Heather
talked about that a lot with the fights that they'd had early on in the 60s and 70s trying to get the news out.
Oh, yeah.
And they would always have disagreements with the editors, and that I can understand.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, those days are gone, Scott. Those days are gone. And frankly, I think we should be bringing them back. And the way to do it, very, very straightforward, go back to the provisions of the Fairness Doctrine, not that necessarily require balance. That's a very difficult thing to achieve, but that require community service, and roll back Clinton's signing of the Telecommunications Act in 96 and start applying the Sherman Act to media. None of these things are going to win me, you know, friends with big media companies, I'll tell you, but it's the truth. That's what's important. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Some interesting science news that I'd like to share with you in just a moment. I've been talking about politics here all day, and moving along on that. And in just a few minutes, we're going to have Nancy Anton with us with newshounds.us. They watch Fox, so you don't have to. She'll bring us up to date on what's going on with Fox. At the bottom of the hour, Senator Barbara Boxer is going to be with us. And by the way, the caller who said that Barbara Boxer voted for CAFTA, I'm sorry, you were wrong. Dianne Feinstein voted for CAFTA. Maria Cantwell voted for CAFTA. Ron Wyden voted for CAFTA. Gordon Smith voted, you know, looking at the Western state senators, all of them voted for CAFTA. Patty Murray voted for CAFTA, except for Barbara Boxer. Barbara Boxer voted no on CAFTA. In fact, we just checked the Senate website. So, anyhow, a new report published today indicates that President George W. Bush briefly contemplated bombing National Public Radio in the run-up to the Iraq War, but it was ultimately talked out of it by British Prime Minister Tony Blair, reports Andy Borowitz at BorowitzReport.com. According to the report, Mr. Blair had just convinced Mr. Bush not to bomb the Arabic language television network Al Jazeera when the president suddenly shifted gears, turning his sights on the left-leaning NPR. The president reportedly said, "Those clowns at NPR have been tearing me a new one, Tony. Well, that's nothing a good old daisy cutter won't fix." Mr. Blair reportedly raised strong objections to Mr. Bush's plan to bomb NPR, after which the president said, "All right, already, I'll just cut their funding instead." According to a source quoted in the report, the president had drawn up an elaborate plan that would involve bombing several prominent media outlets, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Charlie Rose Show. The only thing left standing was Fox News, the source is quoted as saying. Mr. Bush was eventually talked out of bombing the Washington Post when a top aide reminded him, "If we take out the Post, we won't have any way to leak things to Bob Woodward." As for bombing the New York Times, Mr. Bush ultimately backed down from his plan, but suggested launching a smart bomb to take out the op-ed page. Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, who knows? Anyhow, this science stuff, there's some fascinating things in science news that I wanted to share with you. The first one is one that I think should make us all very, very concerned. This is about researchers in Scotland. They were trying to figure out what is there a difference between sewage sludge from cities, you know, this is big business in the United States. For years and years and years, cities were producing sludge from the sewage that was being processed and hauled off and put in landfills or diluted down and put into rivers or whatever. And finally, somebody came up with a bright idea. Why don't we sell this stuff as fertilizer? After all, you know, it's the old compost thing. Compost is made out of animal manure. Why not take human manure and use that to make fertilizer? And, in fact, hundreds of millions of pounds of city sewage sludge in the United States are being applied to fields all over the United States. Some of the food, I don't know what the percentage is, but some of the food that you buy in your local store, if you're not buying organic, may well be fertilized with sewage sludge. Urban and suburban sewage sludge. So these researchers in Scotland, they said, well, let's find out what this stuff does to mammals. Humans being mammals, right? So they tested lambs. They did this for 5 years. For 5 years, they treated lamb pastures, one set of pastures with inorganic fertilizer, just, you know, regular 5-3-20 or whatever they call it. You know, it's the proportions of nitrogen and phosphorus and whatnot, and sewage sludge. And they balanced the amount of nutrients. Actually, using nitrogen as their benchmark, so that the two fields had identical amounts of nitrogen, and so presumably similar nutrients. In other words, they were equally fertilized. It wasn't like they put more sewage sludge on one and less chemical fertilizer on the other or anything like that. So they fertilized these two fields, and they had lambs grazing in them for 5 years. They just finished this study, 5 years. In the fifth year, they write in Science News, pregnant female lambs that had grazed on each field for the study's duration were slaughtered three-quarters of the way through their pregnancies. Although these sheep weighed about the same, the female fetuses from the sludge-treated pastures were 12% smaller, and their brothers, the male fetuses, were anywhere from 15 to 30% smaller than the fetal lambs from the conventionally fertilized sites. Additionally, the testicles of the fetal males from the sludge-fertilized pastures were only two-thirds the size of those from the males from the sludge-free fields. And this is published in the November issue of Environmental Health Perspectives, a national peer-reviewed science journal. Sludge-exposed fetal males also had far lower blood concentrations of testosterone, the primary male sex hormone, and another hormone that is produced by testes cells that produce sperm. Study co-author Richard Sharp of Queen's Medical Research Institute in Edinburgh hypothesizes that unidentified chemicals in sludge caused the diminished testes size and the hormone effects. He said that his group now intends to determine whether the effects persist into adulthood and any effect they may have on the animal's reproductive capacity. If this hypothesis holds, then these chemicals may pose a reproductive risk to people as well, Sharp's team argues. It's pretty startling stuff. Now, it shouldn't actually surprise us. There's an incredible book called The Secret Life of... Is it The Secret Life of Plants? Yeah, it is. That talks about some of these issues. Came out a few years back and talks, you know, right up front about how there are just absolutely mind-boggling amounts, I mean, tons of hormones that humans are taking in the form of tablets and liquids and lotions and potions and whatnot, mostly birth control pills, but also pills to just, you know, deal with premenstrual problems and menarche and all those, menopause, and as well as some hormones that men take. And they pass through the body largely intact. Only a small percentage of them apparently get metabolized. And even the metabolites of some of these substances are still bioactive. They're still able to act on biological systems. And so a lot of our rivers, most all of our rivers now, have detectable levels of estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, other hormones in them, particularly estrogen. So there's that. Plus, there is this entire family of chemicals. We had somebody on this program a few weeks ago talking about this. There's an entire family of chemicals, phthalates, spelled with a PH, that mimic estrogen. The body thinks that it's receiving estrogen, and then they produce estrogen-like effects in the body, even though they're not estrogens, that are used to soften plastic. And these chemicals make their way into the water supply and you know, through the food chain and whatnot, and eventually end up in sewage sludge, presumably eventually end up in sewage sludge. So nobody knows right now what it is in the sludge that's causing this effect, where the female fetus is 12% smaller, the male fetus is up to 36% smaller. But a lot of people are very concerned about this. And this, you know, again, this is the kind of thing, it's showing up in the science publications. I'm reading it in Science News, which I subscribe to. They're quoting environmental health perspectives, a science publication. This is stuff that should be on the front page of the New York Times. But there's a huge industry in the United States. I mean, just Google sewage sludge. You'll get the whole thing. It's a huge industry in the United States committed to making this profitable. Let's go to cities and say, hey, instead of paying to get rid of your waste matter, we will we'll pay you, or we can show you how to make it profitable. So that's number one. Another one, this perhaps a little less politically correct, but about half of women experience a variety of emotional symptoms prior to menstruation, called PMS, premenstrual syndrome. They've actually discovered that there is a physiology associated with this. It's not just hormonal. It has to do with the brain. And they presented women during this period of time, 5 days before their period, with words like safe or delighted, positive words, negative words like fault or death, and neutral words like bookcase or clarinet, and then measured their brain activity. And what they found was that during that period, just before they begin their menstrual cycle, women who were exposed to negative words had a much stronger reaction than normal, indicating that there's almost a kind of hormone-induced, perhaps, paranoia that is associated with PMS. This is a fascinating study. Not drawing any conclusions from that other than it's fascinating stuff. And finally, a diet high in fats may actually cut colon cancer risk. Here, talk about turning conventional science on its head. A diet high in dairy products dramatically reduces the risk of colon cancer, the third most lethal type of cancer. This according to a Swedish study. The catch, to have the effect, the foods must be rich in fat, and specifically dairy fats. This is a 14-year study done on 61,000 women. Colorectal cancer risk fell by 13% when they ate dairy products regularly. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
My name's O.W. and 41's my heart. We hope you enjoy shocking on. Halliburton's here to stay. No electricity today. Pull those in your blues away.
Oh, my.
My name is Rummy. How do you do? Have I got some metrics for you? What is knowable is that I'm full of bulldozing your blues away.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Nancy Anton is with us with newshounds.us. They watch Fox, so we don't have to. Thank God. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, Tom.
Actually, thank Nancy. Nancy, what's the big meme on Fox these days or this week?
Well, a couple of things that happened over the past couple of days. I think last time we discussed briefly about the, quote, attack on Christmas, unquote.
Yes. And now Bill O'Reilly, I'll bet, is out there saying that we should all be, that Jesus is a merchant or something to that effect.
Right, right. And Hannity, of course, has ranted about it, and John Gibson and so on. But my colleague Ellen caught a beautiful little item on the Fox News website over the weekend where the Fox writers wrote a story about holiday trees, which is exactly what the Fox talking heads are whining about, that they're not being called Christmas trees.
Oh, isn't that strange? Of course, you know, the Fox Entertainment Channel runs all the programming that the Fox News Channel complains about. I always thought that was an interesting irony.
Exactly.
But it's completely lost on all the Fox viewers.
Right.
So
on a more serious note, though,
yeah.
Melanie caught a very nice little piece where they were justifying torture, which is a hot-button issue for me.
Mm.
It's one of the things that just makes my blood boil. And they did something that they tend to do. This is a tactic that they love. They found this group, and I use the word loosely. The name of it is American Congress for Truth. And it seems to be a one-person operation.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this all the time. They find these obscure little, you know, one dog, one pony horse show, you know.
Right.
And give them national exposure, as long as they toe the appropriate party line.
Right, and they do this in two ways, really. They'll find ones on the left that are really kind of, you know, whack job, you know, nutcase
yes.
ones, and they'll put them on the air. Or they find ones on the right that are saying the super extreme stuff that nobody really wants to say, but is like the code for everything's being said in code. These guys will say it out loud
yes.
and put them on. So
exactly.
I'm assuming that these people were pro-torture?
Absolutely, because Arabs expect it.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
I see. Just like abused wives.
It's accepted and expected in the Arab world.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the whole rationale of an entire segment. And this, you know, it's appalling to me that anyone could even say that, but that you could give someone a platform to say it nationally is like...
Well, and it feeds racism, it feeds xenophobia, it feeds culturism of the worst kind.
Yes.
And so I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that it was on Fox.
Right. And then, last but not least of the points I'd like to highlight, my colleague Judy, who watches the Business Block on Saturday, found a wonderful discussion about Walmart, where basically the panel was overwhelmingly pro-Walmart because it's cheap. It's low
right.
prices.
Right.
And totally ignored anything like, you know, labor law violations, child labor, overtime regulations that they just
well, ignore. Even the easier response to the it's cheap is, and I'm surprised that I don't hear this more from progressives, is my statement that, you know, we know, for example, that labor is only a small part of the product, of any product, particularly any product sold at retail. They're generally sold at wholesale for half the price of retail, and then they're sold from the manufacturer to the wholesalers at half that cost.
Right.
So, you know, the labor cost, if you double the labor cost of something, you might increase its retail price by 5 or 10% at the most. So what I say is I would gladly pay an extra 10% for the stuff at Walmart if that meant that my paycheck went up 30%.
Oh, that's an excellent point.
I mean, I think everybody in America would gladly pay more, because this is the con talking point. They always say, well, you wouldn't want to pay more for stuff at Walmart, would you? And my answer is, I would be pleased to pay more for stuff at Walmart if my paycheck went up even more. And that's what would happen. If all these jobs came back to the United States, you'd have a middle class again. You'd have people making, instead of making $6, $7, $8, $9 an hour, you'd have people making $15, $20, $25, $30 an hour. And instead of buying, you know, their little Walkman at Walmart for $16, they may have to pay $20 for it. And, gee, we'd be able to afford it, like we could back in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s until Reagan started taking this thing apart and, you know, Reaganomics really started destroying America. And,
yeah.
You know, it's so anyway, that's my favorite anti-meme for them. I noticed that Bill O'Reilly from your website, newsounds.us, Nancy Anton, that you're quoting Bill O'Reilly here as saying every company in America should be on its knees thanking Jesus for being born.
And he comes up with a new silliness every time he opens his mouth, I think. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think they've got people, I think they have comedy writers who come up with this stuff, you know? How far can we push the envelope here on this, you know? You think they'll really buy this one?
That's right.
That's amazing. Nancy Anton, thanks a lot for being with us. Nancy Anton with newshounds.us. Thanks so much. They watch Fox, so we don't have to.
Bye-bye.
And thank you, Nancy. Say hi to your colleagues and friends there for us. Remarkable. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-889. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. The Tom Hartman Radio Program on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, AirAmericaRadio.com, the web stream. Senator Barbara Boxer is with us. Senator, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I am so pleased to have you on. You have a new book out.
Yes.
So tell us about the book.
Sure. Well, I've written my first novel, which is really a very interesting thing. I used to be a journalist. I love writing. And writing is something that I like to do. You know, I always say a lot of senators play golf or paint and have lots of other hobbies, but I love to write. And
mm-hmm.
In 1998, I had this idea for a book, and it came together. But it took me 7 years to get to this point. And it's called A Time to Run, and not surprisingly, it's about my world of politics.
Right. Now, in your book, you have one of the central pieces of it is, and I'm sorry I haven't had an opportunity to read the entire book yet.
That's
but,
all right.
One of the central pieces of it is an argument or a debate or a confirmation battle, whatever, around a Supreme Court justice.
Yes, yes. The book opens in the office of a young female senator from California. She's been there just 2.5 years. And she sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee. The right-wing president has sent down a very right-wing nominee who happens to be a woman from California who's Hispanic. So it puts our senator in a very tough position. And as she's deciding what to do, some very explosive information about the nominee comes forward. And that's how the book opens. And then you go back to, who is this senator? How did she get there? And then it focuses on her days as a college student and this threesome, two men and a woman. Ellen Fisher is the woman, and it goes through their lives and why one becomes a journalist and why one becomes a conservative. It's a sort of a collision course of these three lives.
Senator Boxer, did you write this book because you had a book in you and you had to, you know, just as literally an artistic expression, or was there also an element of you wanted to communicate a message of some sort?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I really wanted to tell a good story,
mm-hmm.
and that was definitely the predominant thing I had in my mind, because if you write a novel, it's got to be a story that, you know, keeps people interested, with dynamic characters and so on, and relationships. But beside that, I just wanted people to come away knowing a lot more about my world of politics, what it's like, how hard it is, how it could be idealistic and wonderful one moment and just brutal the next moment, you know, how people are trying to get your job and bring you down, how journalists can be such a positive force in society or such a negative force.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I explore all of these things, and I hope what people come away with is, A, a good story, and, B, they know more about, you know, my world.
That's marvelous. I think, you know, a lot of people just love reading fiction. It's a way to kind of check out from the world, and if you can be educated through fiction at the same time, it's absolutely great. We're speaking with Senator Barbara Boxer, her new book, A Time to Run, a novel. And Senator Boxer, in this book, you're talking about the Supreme Court nominee. I'm wondering what you expect is going to play out now with Judge Alito. Any advanced thoughts on that?
I think it is too soon to know. What I can tell you is that some of his decisions have been way outside the mainstream. He had one where he said Congress didn't have the right to regulate the sale of fully automatic machine guns, which is so far outside the mainstream. He also said Congress didn't have the right to pass a Family Medical Leave Act that impacted and affected and protected state employees. And on all these things, he was overturned. So there's just more of the same coming, and I am concerned about him. And we're now going through just, you know, literally thousands of pages of his writings.
Senator Barbara Boxer, earlier in the program, a number of our callers and I were kicking around potential, metaphorically speaking, the idea of potential presidential candidates. And I said, and I've been saying for some time on this program, that I have a short list basically of about five people that I would consider ideal presidential candidates, and you're on that list. Do you have any intentions of running for president?
Well, I'm very touched that you would think that. It really means a lot to me. No, I am not intending in any way to go in that direction. I feel that being in the United States Senate is very important, and I feel that there are others that would be more electable nationwide, and I intend to be extremely involved in making sure, first of all, in 06, that Democrats pick up seats in the Senate and House. And one thing I'd like to say to your listeners, you know, we all focus on the next presidential because we're so desperate and we're stuck here for three more years, but there is this interim election, and that interim election is the congressional elections in the Senate and the House. And the only way to check this administration is essentially through that 06 election. So we shouldn't lose sight of that while we focus on 08 as well.
The old balance of powers things, the checks and balances.
Let's
recover
let's
recover the legislative branch at least.
Yes, at 06, and then we'll get ready for 08.
Speaking of the legislative branch, you and Maria Cantwell, as I recall, were trying to get oil company executives sworn in before they testified. Didn't happen. Where's that going to go? I mean, we had the tobacco executives stand up, raise their hands, and say tobacco's not addictive. None of them were ever prosecuted. These oil company executives came in. Apparently, they have not been telling us the truth. Is Congress going to do anything about this?
Well, if I have anything to say about it, yes. I mean, the bottom line is they did not get sworn in. And Ted Stevens said, the chairman, who was so, you know, literally fuming about this notion that we should swear them in. And you're right about the tobacco executives, but even more interesting in terms of precedent is that in the 70s, during the oil crisis then, Scoop Jackson, who was a Democratic senator from Washington State, swore in oil executives at that time, and no one said a word about it. So the fact is we need to get them back because they were not honest with us. They were asked by Senator Lautenberg, who was such a champion of the people, did you participate in Vice President Cheney's energy task force? And to a person, all but one said, oh, no, we didn't participate. And one said, I'm not sure. So they did not tell the truth, and they should come back. But here's the point. Ted Stevens said, Senator Stevens, well, even if they weren't sworn in, they are covered by a law that says you can't lie to the Congress or misrepresent the facts. And that's true. So there's really enough there to bring them forward for prosecution, which we have asked the Justice Department to do just that.
And any response?
Well, not yet, but, you know, the wheels move slowly.
Yeah, these things take time.
We'll push hard.
These things take time. And finally, CAFTA and trade policy in general. The president just came back from China. largely empty-handed and embarrassed, frankly, I would say, both he and the United States in many ways. What do you see as a rational direction for us to be going with regard to trade policy and creating some sort of a national industrial policy once again here in the United States?
Well, that's such a crucial issue. First of all, I'm not sure that Bush was embarrassed. I mean, just, you know, I'm not sure.
He's beyond that.
Let's just say he should be embarrassed.
Yeah.
But let's go on from there. Here's where we stand. I mean, we have to fight for our working people and keeping jobs here in America. There is no question about it. Now, there's enough blame to go around. Let's take the auto industry. For years, we've been begging them, the big three, please look at what the Japanese are doing. Yes, you're making a lot of money on SUVs, but the way oil is going now and into the future, we need to have fuel-efficient vehicles. We could get nowhere with them. And finally, now they're beginning, but they're in terrible shape. But let me say some of the things we need to do right away. Number one, we need to deal with the health insurance crisis in our nation, because one of the reasons our companies are not competitive is they are bearing the brunt of health care, or they're dumping it, and then they're not attracting the best employees. So that's very, very important. Are you still there?
I am, yes. Yeah, you
oh,
faded
good.
Out
Something
for a second, but you're still there.
On the phone. Yeah. So health insurance is very much a part of, as you say, industrialized policy. And we need worker retraining. We need fair trade. You know, there is no such thing as having straight free trade. We'll lose every job. And I don't believe in total protectionism. But in between, we should use our leverage to force these countries to pay decent wages. And we should raise the minimum wage in this country. It hasn't been raised in 9 years. So I think there are many things that we can do right away to help our workers.
Well said. And that in between is where the country, where this country was for 40 years as we built the strongest industrial force in the world from between the 40s and the 80s when Reagan started taking it apart.
No question about it.
Senator Barbara Boxer, your new book is titled A Time to Run. Do you deal with these kinds of issues in the book as well?
I deal with a lot of issues because my Ellen Fisher, who is the senator there, her life is totally different from my life. However, she shares these issues with a passion.
That's marvelous.
We show her fighting the special interests, and I think there's a lot in that book that will make progressives very happy.
Great. Okay. I look forward to reading it. Senator Barbara Boxer, her new book, A Time to Run. Thanks so much for being with us, Senator.
Thank you so much.
Have a marvelous day, and keep up the great work in the United States Senate. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman with you. 5 minutes before the hour, the new firestorm, as it were, that's erupting in the UK, probably underreported in the United States, as most are. But this, the news story, today's Independent, one of the major newspapers in Great Britain. Headline, U.S. lied to Britain over use of napalm in Iraq war. A story, American officials lied to British ministers over the use of internationally reviled napalm-type firebombs in Iraq. Yesterday's disclosure led to calls by members of Parliament for a full statement to the Commons and opened ministers to allegations that they had held back the facts until after the general election, this being the Tony Blair's election just a few weeks ago. Despite persistent rumors of injuries among Iraqis consistent with the use of incendiary weapons such as napalm, Adam Ingram, the defense minister, assured Labour MPs in January that U.S. forces had not used a new generation of incendiary weapons, codenamed MK-77, in Iraq. These, by the way, weapons where the MK-77 bomb, an evolution of the napalm used in Vietnam and Korea, carry kerosene-based jet fuel and polystyrene so that, like napalm, the gel sticks to its victims. The bombs lack stabilizing fins, making them far from precise. Okay. Mr. Ingram said 30 MK-77 firebombs were used by the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force in the invasion of Iraq between 31 March and 2 April 2003. Mr. Ingram did not explain why U.S. officials had misled him. U.S. authorities only admitted the use of the weapons after the evidence from reporters had become irrefutable. We are looking really bad, even to our allies right now. What the Bush administration has completely trashed our reputation all over the planet. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up? We got about 30 seconds here left.
Well, good morning, Tom. It's good to talk to you again. 30 seconds is just great. Listen, I'm hearing the war dead in Iraq are actually a lot higher, that they're closer to 7,000 or more because they are not counting men, soldiers who die on the way to the hospital or in the hospital days later after being wounded. The number is much higher, but unfortunately, Tom, I can't find the reference for that.
Yeah, I can't either. And actually, I saw that in one of the reports a few weeks ago that listed, you know, who died and all that sort of thing, one of the people who they listed as having died had died in Germany in the hospital. So I think if they weren't counting them before, they are now.
So, I hope so. I think the war dead's a lot higher. We should really know the true count.
Yeah, but it really doesn't matter. I mean, 1,700 people is a lot of people. If it's even one person who's dead, I'm, you know, as a result of a lie by George Bush, I'm outraged. That you know, one would be one more than happened as a result of Bill Clinton's lies and that got him impeached. And here we have 1,700 Americans dead. 20 to 30,000 have lost arms and legs and eyes and in some cases their minds or their ability to mentally function. 100,000 dead Iraqis. The price has been too high. Absolutely too high, particularly since Iraq represented no threat to us and had nothing to do with 9/11. See you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.